Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Editorial Review, the Law Hour and Editorial Review, brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on legal analysis when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider, and an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Back in 1880, Swinton had this comment to make. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Well, Swinton absolutely outraged all of his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. Now, you know it and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinion out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things. And any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. Now, if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now, you know it and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We're the jumping jacks, and they pull the strings and we dance. Our talents and our possibilities and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Well, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program, this New World Order. They're the men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that we ought to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order, this Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, call and order our free 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. Legal analysis. Oftentimes people call or come to school and they have a legal problem, and when you ask them, are you guilty? They always say, no, I am not guilty. Now, as a statistical matter of fact, 85% of the time when the government accuses you of doing something, you're guilty. You actually did it. You were actually prohibited from doing it. Or you were required to do it, and you did not do it. You intended not to do it, or you intended to do it. Or, if intent isn't an element of the crime, then you did it, and you had agreed previously by adhesion contract that you wouldn't do it. So you're really guilty, but somehow in your mind you don't believe that I'm guilty. I don't believe I could do something that wicked or that bad or that I actually accomplished that goal. Now, here on the Law Hour, we talk a lot about unusual cases where you actually do something and you get away with it. And that really attracts people. The idea that I can drive down the highway at 90 miles an hour and get away with it appeals to people. It appeals to our vanity. We really want to be able to do what other people can't. I remember one time years ago, the sheriff of Ozark County was transporting me to another county jail. Yes, it's true, I was in jail. And they were moving me from Ozark County up to, well, I think it was Texas County. And I noted while we were driving up there, it was the sheriff's personal car. It was a little kind of a sports jobby. I don't remember exactly what the brand was on it, but it was kind of a little sporty car. And I just kind of looked over, you know, a time or two, and he was holding it right at 85. 85. And I thought, no, look at this. The speed limit, this is way back in the old days when they had the speed limit at 55, you know, back in the 80s. The speed limit here is 55, and here's the sheriff of Ozark County driving 85. Now, we didn't get stopped going up there, and I don't remember seeing any highway patrol or anything else, but you can rest assured that if the sheriff, his name was Jimmy Shaw, you can rest assured that if any highway patrolman had seen Sheriff Jimmy Shaw driving down the road in his personal automobile at 85 miles an hour, never would have said a word about it. They wouldn't have stopped him and given him a ticket. Now, there was no emergency. He did not have his red lights on. He wasn't using his siren. He was just exercising his power as the sheriff to do something that all the rest of us want to do, drive 85 and get away with it. Now, we all desire to do that, and so what we do is we get a fuzz buster, you know, a radar detector, and we put that in our car. That's the next best thing. That way we can be warned in advance that the police up the road here have a radar gun, so then we slow down to 55, and then we drive past the cop, and then we speed back up to 85. It's hypocrisy. It's an act that we're putting on. We're not the sheriff, and we don't have a license to drive 85, but we want to do it anyway. And so we resort to hypocrisy. It's just part and parcel of human nature, just nothing new. Now, the reason I bring that up is to kind of set the table here so that as we progress along, we're going to take a look at this legal analysis from the point of view of the judges, or the point of view of the law, the point of view of the lawmaker, the point of view of the prosecutor. In order to enforce the law, Jimmy Shaw should have been stopped, should have been ticketed for driving 85 miles an hour. He should have been brought in. He should have had points put on his license. It didn't happen, isn't going to happen, and will never happen. Well, not in this lifetime. But it ought to, because it sets a bad example, and in fact, it is illegal. It's a crime, and all crime should be punished. Crime should be abolished. Crime is bad for all of us. So what I do here on the Law Hour is point this out, that crime among the police should be stopped. Crime among the citizenry should be stopped. Crime isn't good for any of us. Crime is a violation of a rule. Now, we make these rules because this is the way the game is played. How would you like to play a game, say, of Monopoly? And while we're playing Monopoly over here, you happen to fall on the square that says, go to jail. And so your opponent over here, you know, say he falls on that square, and then he pulls his get-out-of-jail-free card. Remember that famous get-out-of-jail-free card? See, so that he doesn't have to lose a turn. What if this guy had six get-out-of-jail-free cards up his sleeve, and every time he falls on go to jail, he pulls out one of these cards, and he gets out free, but when you get onto the square, you have to lose your turn. Wouldn't that be unfair? You know, when we see that, we say, well, wait a minute, this guy's cheating. Well, that's what crime is. Crime is cheating. Goldman Sachs is cheating. The government, when they print money, they're cheating. That's called inflation. And this cheating goes on constantly all around us, and it perverts our judgment. It destroys our morals. And so, here on the Law Hour, I thought, well, let's take a look at legal analysis from the perspective of the lawmakers, and how do we determine whether or not you are in fact guilty? And sometimes people say, hey, I want to learn how to get out of it like you do, Mr. Gordon. Wait a minute. I'm not here to get out of anything. It is not the purpose of the Law Hour or the editorial review to turn you into criminals or to teach crime. This is not Crime School 101. This is law school. Law school is where we teach people to practice the law. And that's why we go back to the scripture so often, because the scripture is the final authority on law. What our problem is that we're not using the scripture. The Congress does not pick up the scripture and say, we're going to enact a law here. Let's make sure that it doesn't violate the law of God. They don't do that. The laws enacted by Congress are designed to circumvent and violate the law of God. That's why they license the Jimmy Dean Pure Pork Sausage Company. They license them to manufacture and sell pig in violation of Leviticus 11, verse 7. The purpose of secular government is to violate the law of God. In fact, in our state here, Missouri, in 1820, we wrote a statute. The first statute at large in our state is an authority to violate the common law. The common law is the law of God. And it says that the common law shall be the law of Missouri unless it is repealed or changed by the legislature. The very purpose of the legislature is to repeal or to reform or to change the law of God. That's why they're there. In fact, the scripture tells us plainly that we are not to alter, reform, or change the law of God in any way. That's in Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, and Deuteronomy 12, 32. The creation of a legislature, a city council, a county commission, or a Congress is a violation of those two statutes. Now, I'm not sitting here telling you, you know, you need to abolish your Congress. That isn't going to happen, or your state legislatures. You people aren't going to do that. I just wanted to tell you in advance so that when the penalty comes down upon our heads, we all have a heads up. We all know, well, yeah, we're getting punished, and here's why. Otherwise, you'd be left here saying, oh, my God, we're getting punished, and we haven't got a clue. Now, for instance, down in Louisiana, there's a punishment going on down there. The people of Louisiana, and I don't want to single you people out down there. You're not the only criminals in the country. But you people down there have a particular fetish about a particular kind of crime, which is called food, and particularly unclean food. In Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14, the creator of the universe comes along and he says, I don't want you to eat anything out of the water that doesn't have fins and scales. The three biggest crops, the three biggest catches of fish down in Louisiana are called shellfish. They're oysters, crabs, and shrimp. Now, when Hurricane Katrina came through, it didn't send any of you people a message down there, and you went back to it. Now you got this giant oil spill down there that's screwing up your estuaries and your fishing industry, and you still don't get it. It doesn't make any difference if the oil kills all of the oysters, all the shrimps, and all the crabs, because they're illegal and lawful, a tort and a trespass, and they're a violation of the law of God for you to catch them, sell them, process them, cook them, or eat them. Somebody's going to write me a letter and say, well, then why did God make them? God made arsenic, but he didn't make it to eat. There's all kinds of things out there, boys and girls, that God made that aren't made to eat. They're made for something else. Let's wake up. Get real. But, you know, not to sit here and rail against people and their punishments that are coming down on them, but if somebody doesn't say, hey, let me explain it to you. It's just like 1, 2, 3, you know. It's no big mystery over here. there's a punishment that comes down. And so the fishermen down there, they're all crying the blues, and they're saying, oh, my God, what are we going to do next? You're going to go broke is what's going to happen. You're going to get wiped out. You're going to be destroyed. And the word destroy is used quite often in the Scripture. Now, when we pull this legal analysis over then under the secular law, the state of Louisiana does the same thing. They come along and the legislature wants to make a law. The legislature is a sovereign lawmaking authority. God is a sovereign lawmaking authority. That's what a sovereign is. It's a lawmaking authority. Go look up the word sovereign and tell you it's a lawmaker. So the Louisiana legislature comes along and they say, okay, well, let's make driving 75 miles an hour against the law, and 55 is the speed limit. Buckle your seat belt. That's a law. Buy auto insurance. That's a law. Drive on the right side of the road. That's a law. So you got all these laws down here, and the legislature enacts these laws, and they tell you it's for the health, safety, and welfare of the public. It isn't. It isn't. If there is some benefit to the health, safety, and welfare of the public, that's fine. But the laws are enacted for commercial purposes. They're there to make money for somebody. All legislative bodies do that. The only exception to that is the law of God. The only guy that's really concerned about health, safety, and welfare of the public is your Creator. All the rest of them are out to make money. The speed limit law, the seatbelt law, the compulsory insurance law, those are designed to sell insurance and protect the claims window of the insurance industry from any claims. That's why you buckle your seatbelt, because if you go through the windshield, it costs the insurance company more money. The reason you have to buy insurance is because the legislature has decreed it. And one of these days, they will decree that you have to buy big screen TVs, or you have to buy Reebok tennis shoes, or you have to buy carpet or something else. I mean, if they can compel you to buy insurance, why can't they compel you to buy carpet? It's just that the carpet companies haven't woken up to the fact that, hell, the insurance companies can come in here and get a law made and make everybody buy their product, so why don't we go in and get a law made that'll make everybody buy our product? See how that works? They haven't come to that conclusion yet, but they will one of these days, and then, you know, there you'll have some new laws. Well, those laws don't have anything to do with your health, safety, or welfare. Now, when people break these laws, they themselves believe that they're innocent, and somebody is charged with the job of showing that they are guilty. We've got to come in here and show that, hey, you broke this law here. And this falls on the judge, and more likely it falls on the appellate court judge. So the appellate court judge, he does what's called a legal analysis. He looks at the record, he looks at the statute, and by this time you've claimed that this statute's unconstitutional. And so he's looking at it and he says, well, let's see, is this law unconstitutional on its face? Is it unconstitutional as it's applied to this person? Or is there some other answer? So let's take a look at an example of legal analysis as it relates to, let's say, the income tax. You're charged with willful failure to file, tax evasion, or something along that line. And so you are brought in and you come in, you testify, and maybe you don't testify. Maybe somebody else testifies against you. This is the IRS agents. They come in, they testify. You didn't file, and you didn't pay any tax. Now, the jury is sitting there. Now, the jury, you see, they're all filing, and they're all paying. And so they're prejudiced against you coming out of the chute right from the get-go because, well, I got to pay the tax, so he has to pay the tax. That's not necessarily true. Not at all. You might not be a taxpayer, and the 12 members of the jury might all be taxpayers. And as a result of that, maybe you don't owe a tax. For instance, we'd have to determine, well, where did this money come from? Let's suppose that you had tax-exempt municipal bonds, and you made $1 million in interest and didn't file your tax return, and you didn't pay any tax. What would be the crime here? Well, the crime would be willful failure to file because you did, in fact, have $1 million worth of income. but you're not guilty of tax evasion. So the appellate court judge would come back and he would modify the jury verdict. He would say, well, you came to the right conclusion in part. The guy is guilty of willful failure to file, but he's not guilty of tax evasion because the money that he earned was money that was tax exempt anyway. The law requires that he file a return, declare his $1 million, take his exemption, and go about his business. He didn't do that. So he's partly guilty, but he's not totally guilty. Now, unfortunately, lay people don't understand those subtle legal distinctions, and so they just say, oh, he's guilty, throw him in jail. Well, judges can't do that. That's why we hire these appellate court judges. We want them to take a look at this and see if the police and the politicians are following the rules, that they're not just pulling get-out-of-jail-free cards out of their sleeves, you know. They got to obey the rules, too. That's the purpose behind this. Now, there's a story that I tell you quite often, and it's about the scale down at Bliss, Idaho. You remember we used to drive past the scale, blow the scale, as they say. And the police down there, they saw that, and they said, well, wait a minute. This guy Gordon over here is an anarchist and a criminal, and he needs to be brought to justice. And so Officer Mogenden comes out and gives me a ticket and hauls me off to jail. And I come up to Judge Becker. Now, I went in the first time, if you'll remember, and I argued the case under Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. And then the judge said to me, he said, you know, that's a BS argument, and you ain't going anywhere with that. The correct argument is, was the truck loaded or empty? Now, here's the statute. It says all trucks loaded with, colon, shall, and then it lists 40 items on the list. You know, things like lumber or steel or hay or whatever. And then at the bottom it says, shall stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in a port of entry, period. And the judge gave me my English lesson. He said, who's required to stop, enter, clear, and pay duty at the scale? And I said, I don't know. See, I went to public school. I don't know. And he said, empty trucks. And I looked at it again, and I says, oh, it didn't say anything about empty trucks. And the judge said to me, oftentimes, what isn't said is more eloquent than what is said. So I learned a valuable lesson, and so now I'm passing it on to you. Oftentimes, when we're reading a law, statute, rule, custom, usage, or practice, what isn't being said may be more eloquent than what is being said. So I went back and tested it again. In fact, I tested that law 5 times in the same court, and I won every time. First time I didn't win on the merits of the issue, which was, is the truck loaded or empty? It was on counsel question. But the next 4 times I won was on the issue of, is the truck loaded or empty? I knew the answer, the judge knew the answer, but the prosecutor didn't. And the judge never told the prosecutor what the answer to the riddle was. After all, he told me, he said he went to law school, he's supposed to know. He's smarter than you, you're just a truck driver. That's what he told me. He says, hey, you're not supposed to know this, you're just a truck driver. But the judge, upset about the law, he said to me, I have been before the Transportation Committee, the Judiciary Committee. I have voiced my concerns and my opposition and my complaint with our state Supreme Court. And he said, nobody wants to listen to me. So I said, well, if anybody can come in here and argue this correctly, he said, then I would I'd cut him loose. Then a funny thing happened during the trial, the first trial. The judge came up to me through the back of the court, you know, and he put his arm on my shoulder and he says, God, I wish I had this case. I would win it in 5 minutes. Then he went up and sat down, presided over my blundering attempt to win my case, and I lost it. And then the judge took me back into chambers, and he said, now, you know, if you could argue this correctly, you know, I'd cut you loose. And so I went in, argued it correctly, and sure enough, he turned me loose. And all of the highway patrolmen, the prosecution, and everybody there with the government was gasping in horror. How much did Gordon pay that judge to buy him off? And the answer was, I didn't pay him a dime, and I didn't buy anybody off. There's the law, and the law says empty trucks don't have to stop at the scale. But because it doesn't spell it out, it doesn't say anything about empty trucks. It just omits them totally. Tuck this away in your heart, boys and girls, because here's what a crime is. A crime requires an act with intent. If you have an act, but you don't have intent, you don't have a crime. If you have intent, but you don't have an act, you don't have a crime. The way we have a crime is when we have an act with intent. Now, somebody's going to say, well, I didn't intend to speed. Yeah, you did. If you have a driver's license, the license is the prima facie evidence of your intent to break the law. How do I know that? Because of the definition of the word license. You see, the word license, even by itself, is intent. The license is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. So when you went down to get the license, you intended to commit some act that was illegal, unlawful, some act that was a tort, some act that was a trespass. That's why you got the license. You had to have the license, otherwise you'd be guilty of some illegal, unlawful, tort, or trespass. So a license, then, oven by itself, is not illegal under the civil law, but it is always illegal under the common law. So all of you people out there that have marriage licenses, birth certificates, and driver's licenses, and business licenses, you know, all these licenses and permits and so on, those are all contracts with foreign and alien gods. They're acts of treason against the Creator. They're prima facie evidence of your criminal intent, to which the Creator, God, you know, we call him God, he says, I'm going to punish you. And so Hurricane Katrina is a punishment. How do I know that? Well, listen, under the terms and conditions of our contract with our God, he said, I will make everything that your hand touches prosper. Hurricane Katrina was not prosperity. One of your 33 benefits, another one, that's one benefit. There's 33 of these benefits. Another benefit that you receive is rain in due season. Hurricane Katrina is not rain in due season. Now, we're expecting a hurricane season. These hurricanes are a punishment from God. It's the opposite of rain in due season, and it's the opposite of everything you put your hand to will prosper. And I'm beginning to wonder about this oil spill down here. If it doesn't have the fingerprints of the Creator of the universe all over it, it's looking more and more suspicious to me. I'm watching the evidence pile up here, and it looks like to me that BP was the agent of the Creator of the universe for the express purpose of destroying the fishing industry of Louisiana and the Gulf Coast, because you people down there in violation of Leviticus 11, verse 7. So I'm just throwing that out there. It isn't just Leviticus 11:7. It's Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. So that's another example of this thing of legal analysis. We're trying to put cause and effect together, and we're trying to arrive at a conclusion. Now, oftentimes a court will come back. In fact, I just had a case come down the other day in which one of my students filed an appeal with the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Eighth Circuit came back. The Eighth Circuit came back, and they said, well, the trial court judge erred. He came to the right conclusion in dismissing this suit, but he came to that conclusion for all of the wrong reasons. You see, the district court dismissed it and said they didn't have subject matter jurisdiction, and the appellate court comes back and says, oh, yeah, yeah, the district court does have subject matter jurisdiction, but it should be dismissed. They did the right thing, but they did it for the wrong reason. So let's correct that error and came back and said, here's the reason it should be dismissed. Something totally separate and distinct. Now, that's what legal analysis is all about. So let me give you a little example of how this legal analysis works. Back in the 1930s, there was a mayor in New York City. His name was LaGuardia. They named an airport after him. Mayor LaGuardia. He was an Italian fellow. He wasn't too tall. I think he was barely 5 feet tall. And he was a pretty outspoken fellow. A kind of a take-charge type. Well, anyway, he's sitting in his office one day. A secretary comes in, streaming tears down her cheeks. And he says, what's wrong? And she says, there are two big, burly iron workers outside my window. They were building an extension onto the city hall. And there was a construction project going on. And she said, my window was open. And these two big, burly iron workers were using filthy language, obscene language, profanity. And it has upset my sensitivities and made me cry. The mayor, just absolutely incensed that these men would be outside his secretary's window using bad words, called the city's engineer, and said, hey, I want you to bring those, find out who they were, number one, and two, bring them into my office. I want to talk to them. So that afternoon, here comes Pat and Harold into the mayor's office, and they're very contrite, had their hats in their hands, and the mayor, you know, he's not too big anyway, not too tall, and he just reads them the riot act about their profanity and their use of bad words and one thing and another, and told them about how his secretary was incensed and saddened, and so he said, I want a full explanation. So Harold, he steps forward and he says, well, Your Honor, Mr. Mayor, I think maybe I could explain it. And he said, see, we were outside on the steel, 16 stories above the ground, balanced precariously on an 8-inch wide beam. And our job was to pass rivets up to the riveters. And these rivets are heated down below, and they're red hot. And Pat would take a rivet, and he would throw it up to me with a tong, and I would catch it in a bucket and pass it on to the riveter. Well, Pat tossed up a rivet, and I missed the rivet in the bucket, and it hit the rim of the bucket and bounced off. And it fell down onto my boot. And needless to say, it was pretty hot, so I kicked it off of my boot, and it rolled across the beam, and it tipped off, and it went down, and it hit Pat on his hard hat. And it rolled around the rim of Pat's hard hat, and then fell off onto his shoulder, and then down into his coveralls, and then down his leg and into his boot. And that's when it happened, Your Honor. That's when it happened. That's when Pat looked up at me and said, for goodness sakes, Harold, would you please be more careful? Now, if we were going to do a legal analysis of this, do you believe for a minute that this big burly iron worker down here looked up at Harold and said, for goodness sakes, Harold, would you please be more careful? So there's another element that comes in here. It's called common sense. From our experiences in life, does our common sense tell us that that probably is not the normal reaction of the normal iron worker working 16 stories or 8 stories or 4 stories above the ground? It probably isn't. Now, is it? Hey, we're talking about legal analysis. It's the halfway point. Let me give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Now, once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on the archives page and download that free general law CD package right there, georgegordon.org. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements and recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. They may not like us at all. So keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about legal analysis. Now, just before we took our break here, I told you a little story here about Pat and Harold. What Pat and Harold did out on the construction site is not against the law. Using bad language isn't against the law. But notice that the mayor called them in and read them the riot act. He corrected them. He said, "This is bad, bad, naughty, naughty." Well, there are some examples, though, where filthy speech or obscene speech is not allowed. On the radio, for instance, or television. And court cases have come down over the years to direct and guide us along that way. Now, here in America, we have a protection called free speech. Free speech. And the free speech also covers obscene speech, profane speech, and vulgar speech. Now, vulgar, profane, and obscene are not synonymous terms. Oftentimes, people do err, not understanding the words and the definitions and the meanings of those words. And many times, they will enact laws, customs, usages, practices that aren't necessarily against the law, but what they believe ought to be against the law. And the mayor is a classic case. This story about the mayor here as it deals with free speech is pretty important. There are some places where you can't use certain speech. It's against the law to do that, for which there are penalties. For instance, here on the internet, as an example, if you were to use child pornography or obscene speech with somebody that's underaged, you know, that's a crime. Can't do that. If you were on radio or television and you're Leno or David Letterman or something, and you use the wrong words, they're not very many. There's three or four four-letter words you can't use on the air. But there are a lot of four-letter words that you can use on the air. That's not against the law. But it violates the conscience of people. And this is why you'll see on television, oftentimes they'll start off, they'll say, the content of the following program might have a lot of blood and gore in it, or words that are offensive, and so therefore you probably ought not to watch this. And sometimes movies, you know, which is free speech in the movie house, cannot be rebroadcast on a television program, and so they have to bleep that word out. And so you can see the movie, but then when it comes to that word, it goes bleep, you know, and then it protects your sensitivities. And the reason that CBS does that, like, you remember Janet Jackson, you know, sure, her bra came off, you know, on the halfway time, or at the halfway show in the Super Bowl, and they had to pay a big fine for that, see, because that violated the law. Now, there's a big difference between the violation of a law and the violation of some custom, usage, or practice. So, judges, you know, in the case of Mayor LaGuardia, he probably would have liked to have seen these two guys fined $100 and put in jail for a week as punishment. But that wasn't a crime, and you can't prosecute these people. There's another example of this in the February 2010 issue of the National Geographic magazine. There's a story in there about polygamy. Now, polygamy in the United States is prohibited by statute. You know, boys, you can't have two wives. And then the story is about 30,000 polygamists that belong to an offshoot of the Mormon Church that are practicing polygamy, and they've got pictures of one guy there with 256 descendants. And he's 88 years old and has five wives. And so the question arises, well, why doesn't the prosecutor prosecute him? And they ask this prosecutor, and he says, well, you don't understand. It's not as easy as it sounds. Okay, well, why isn't it? What is it that this prosecutor knows? See, lay people, they look at that and they say, how can you have this article in the National Geographic identifying 30,000 polygamists, a prosecutor that says it's not as easy as it sounds, and a law that's against the law, but they don't prosecute it? And so lay people are confused. They don't understand that. But if we did a legal analysis of it, we could understand it. And so I'm going to give you that legal analysis. It's fairly simple. It goes back to 1876 when Congress enacted the first statute that says thou shalt not commit polygamy, which I want to emphasize does not come from the Bible. The Bible has 24 examples of polygamy, and polygamy is a social status created by God Almighty Himself. It was that we humans here in America decided that polygamy was bad. It was a mistake that God made, and we wanted to fix his mistake, so we did. Congress fixed God's mistake. That's just one of many examples of Congress fixing God's mistakes. He's full of them. And so we're full of corrections. And so a guy named Reynolds gets prosecuted for it and jailed, and then the Supreme Court weighs in on it and decides the case. They did a legal analysis, and when they got through, they said he's guilty, and they sent him off to jail. Now, is polygamy against the law? And the answer is no. No, polygamy doesn't violate the law of the United States. Polygamy does not violate the law of Utah. And polygamy does not violate the law of God. Polygamy is lawful and legal. But there is a way that you can practice polygamy that's against the law. And if you practice polygamy with a marriage license, you're in violation of the law of the United States, you're in violation of the law of Utah, and you're in violation of the law of God. You've got all three gods against you. If you practice polygamy without a marriage license, Now you're in compliance with the law of the United States, the law of Utah, and the law of God. And these 30,000 polygamists are practicing it without a marriage license, or at least, if they do, they're unable, that is, the state authorities are unable to put the dots together and to connect it with a prosecution. So when students come here to the law school, and sometimes Mormon polygamists do that, I say, well, you've got a marriage license. Well, yes, I do. That makes you guilty. You're guilty. And another guy comes in and says, no, I don't have a marriage license, but I do have two wives. I say, well, that's not a crime. Nothing wrong with that. Now, if you're sitting in the classroom here, when you hear me say that and you're a Christian, immediately you are offended. Why, of course that's against the law. That's wicked, evil, terrible, and awful. Well, yeah, according to your church doctrine, it probably is wicked and evil and terrible and awful. And I wouldn't argue with you. I mean, shucks. That's why Congress enacted the law to start with. It was to protect the sensitivities of the other Christians out here. They didn't like it. And so Congress said, well, we'll fix God's mistake. God has made a law here that tests our sensitivities. Now, there's quite a few laws in the Bible that people don't like. And so they go to their legislatures and they have those laws overturned. For instance, people like to eat pig, and they want laws that will coincide with their beliefs. And as a result of that, they've come up with the Jimmy Dean pure pork sausage law that legalizes pork, that legalizes integration, that legalizes interracial marriage, that legalizes unjust weights and balances by use of mortgages and Federal Reserve notes and credit cards. They have legalized witchcraft by calling it a religion. They have legalized sodomy by simply repealing the sodomy laws. They have legalized abortion by using birth certificates. And they've legalized usury by setting interest rates. And legalized voting by making it a constitutional provision. And they've legalized the census by writing it right into their constitution. So I'm going to sit here. I just did this, you know, recently. I did a series of programs here on the laws of the scripture, 82 laws of the scripture that we're in violation of. And so the legislature is busily repealing the laws of God and replacing those laws with new statutes and new laws and new customs and usages and practices. So we've made things that were not against the law in the past, criminal offenses. Now, here's another couple, three examples. God does not care whether you buckle your seatbelt or not. Because under the doctrine that the Creator has made for us, it's called strict liability. It's your responsibility to protect yourself in an auto crash. And if you select an airbag to do that, that's fine. If you select a seatbelt to do that, that's fine. If you select to place your children in the back seat, that's fine. If you elect to put your children out on the hood as a hood ornament, that's fine too. No, it's your choice. It's your kid. But you have to be responsible for the outcome. And this responsibility is something that people don't want. I want to be free to have sex with anybody that I want, but I don't want premarital pregnancy and I don't want venereal disease. Well, okay, I understand that. But in the real world, we cannot guarantee that this girl isn't going to get pregnant, and we cannot guarantee that there isn't going to be some venereal disease here. We can guarantee that you won't get venereal disease if you don't practice adultery or fornication. But if you practice adultery and fornication and or, then we can't guarantee it. Human beings want to have it both ways. They want two bites at the apple. They want six get-out-of-jail-free cards up their sleeves. They want to cheat. They don't want to follow the rules. They don't want certain things. Well, okay. Now, as a result of that, we get results. Judges then have to look at the results and then make a legal analysis and come to a conclusion. Did this guy break the law or not? So if Mayor LaGuardia had prosecuted these two men, said, and he would have liked to, some judge somewhere would have said, well, okay, it's bad manners, and it's obscene, and it's profane, and it's vulgar for these two men to be out here on the job using bad words. But it's not against the law. It's protected by free speech. And he would have to decide, turn them loose. Now, sometimes overzealous police officers will arrest people and jail them. The guy hasn't broken the law, but the police officer pretends that he did. Then he charges him with a crime and he locks him up. Well, when that happens once, you know, it's pretty hard for a judge to come to a conclusion and say the police officer here is using his powers, his police powers, to violate somebody's rights. He's breaking the law here. But if the policeman does that 2, 3, 4, 5 times, and if these people come in and complain about it 2, 3, 4, 5 times, it sets up a pattern of behavior with a particular police officer who does this routinely. Then we have a Civil Rights Act that comes into play, and then we can prosecute the officer over here for false arrest and false imprisonment. Sometimes you can catch the officer the first time out with false arrest and false imprisonment. Not often, but once in a while. It's kind of like catching somebody the first time out with VD that commits fornication. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen from time to time. Now, in the case of the secular law here, the judge that makes his analysis of the Constitution, the statutes, the person who is accused of the offense, makes a legal analysis and then comes to a conclusion and says, okay, we're going to turn this guy loose or we're going to lock him up. In the case of Reynolds with the polygamy, they said, lock him up. The guy's guilty. The presumption was that he had a marriage license, and so his error was in his pleadings, not in the discriminatory policy that the court exercised against Mormons. Although it may well be true that the seven justices at the time on the Supreme Court were in fact anti-Mormon. But their decision is not reflective of their biases and their prejudices. It was reflective of the fact that Reynolds pled not guilty, pled into a fiction of law, and then didn't come back and testify that he didn't have a marriage license. As the Supreme Court of Idaho once said to me, if Gordon could prove he owned the automobile, we'd have a much different case before us. Send you a signal. It says, uh-oh, you failed to prove that you owned the automobile. See what happens here? Now, when the judge said to me, this is Judge Becker, when he said to me, that's a BS argument. The correct issue is under the statute, is the truck loaded or empty? It was a total surprise to me. But the jurist simply read the statute and said, well, the statute doesn't ban, require, or prohibit empty trucks one way or the other. They're totally omitted. And so a legal analysis then would say that as a matter of fact, he's guilty because he didn't stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in the port of entry. But as a matter of law, he's innocent, and the law prevails. Therefore, cut him loose. So, what this boils down to you and I, as a student walking into the class, understand this, that when the government charges you with an offense, it can be an act or an omission, 85% of the time they're right. You are guilty. But 15% of the time they are wrong, and you are not guilty. And oftentimes, people go in and plead guilty when, in fact, they are innocent. But they believe that they're guilty. They're fully persuaded that they are guilty. Let me show you an example. I had a friend named Peter Watt, and Pete and I were charged with polluting the air under the Clean Air Act. And Peter went in and pled guilty. Paid a $300 fine, and he believed he was guilty and that that was the right thing to do. Now, I didn't subscribe to that, so I pled not guilty and went in and argued the case. When it was all said and done, the judge came back, dismissed the case, and I walked out free. Can my friend Peter now come in and have his conviction, his guilty plea overturned? And the answer is no. No, 1,000 times no. He went in, pled guilty. He was free, white, and 21 when he did it. And it was a contract. He wanted to do it. The judge asked him, are you doing this of your own free will? And he said yes. Now, you can't come back later just because there's no law. There was no clean air law. He pled guilty to a law that didn't exist. He believed that he was guilty. And he had an act with intent. He said, I intended to pollute the air. I did, in fact, pollute the air. And yes, I want to be punished. Now punish me. And the court said, well, okay, if you believe you're guilty and you want to be punished, then we will go ahead and punish you. I came in and said, I'm not guilty, and I don't want to be punished. I didn't do this. And the judge looked at it and said, well, in that case, then, Mr. Gordon, you didn't break any law because there's no law here to break, and therefore you're innocent, and therefore we're going to dismiss the charges and you can walk. Now, lay people look at that and they say, well, that isn't fair. That isn't right. That disturbs my sensibilities. And I'm not here to tell you right and wrong. I'm here to report facts. Got that? I'm just a reporter. I'm here to report these facts. This is the way the game's played. This is the way it works out on the street. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is the world that we all live in. This is the world that we all have to live in and are going to continue to live in. You might as well get used to it. And if you understand it, then life will be a little better for you. It's like my old daddy said, you know, learn to sit down, shut up, fold your hands, do what you're told. He says life will be a lot easier for you. All right, so that's what legal analysis is all about. Now, I'm going to tell you a story. We'll start next time here on the Law Hour. And I've got a case that I'm going to plead for all of you students out there. And I'm gonna let you play the part of the jury. And I'm gonna let you decide. And I'm gonna come in and I'm gonna put up a defense. And I'm gonna tell you what the charges are, and then I'm gonna tell you what the law is, and then I'm gonna give you my defense. And some of you people out there are going to say, you know, Gordon, you're guilty as hell, and I think you ought to be punished, and it's your just deserts. And then some of you are going to say, well, wait a minute, I think that he's innocent, and I don't think that he should be punished, and I don't think that he should be upbraided for this. And then others of you will have some shade of opinion in between. But as a judge, everybody should come to the same conclusion. Whether your personal views are for or against a particular policy or act, like abortion, it doesn't make any difference. Did the judge decide the case correctly based upon the law and the Constitution, based upon the rules, irrespective of your personal opinion or your personal views? That's really the test of legal analysis. It isn't what is your personal view, it's what is the law. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. And if you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow. tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.